You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we are very happy to be joined. We're very happy to be back. And as this is our first live to air program in 2026. So happy new year, everyone. And I hope you enjoyed the past three programs that we prepared for on 3CR, and also give a credit to Jordan and Harry, who prepared those summer programming for us over the past 3 weeks, and I hope listeners enjoyed.
Before we begin, 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, the original rightful sovereign owners of this land. Australia was founded on the attempted genocide and displacement of the First People, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to always support decolonisation and stand with all First Nations people in their struggle for justice. And yeah, it's good to be back in the studio. Chloe here with Jacob as well as presenters, and a revolutionary and happy new year to our listeners. And yeah, it is good to be back in the studio as we enter another year in the struggle against our class enemies, against the capitalists, against the imperialists, Green Left, and the activists who write for it, and the readers, and hopefully most of you listening right now are continuing to support climate justice and democracy and equality, peace, all the good stuff, eco-socialism, and continue to build the socialist movement.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in terms of the beginning of this year, we've very much seen the kind of capitalist kind of work a bit overtime. In fact, we couldn't even get a break, actually, yeah. Because already from the beginning of this year, we've already actually, there's been a lot of kind of major events. Mm. So it all started off with the kidnapping of the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro, which is going to be the subject of an interview with Federico Ferrantes from Green Left, who is going to be talking to us about the political situation in Venezuela following the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, and also the US imperialism's, you know, plans to really take over the wealth of Venezuela. And pretty much, you know, destroy their sovereignty. And then we're going to be also, another major event has been the protests that have unfolded in Iran, which is not a completely straightforward story. And that's why we're going to be talking to Damoun Jihani, who is a Kurdish Iranian and left winger, who's going to be giving us a bit of background on the protests in Iran around 8:10 a.m. Then, of course, the other kind of major event, the major events that have sort of happened in the past several weeks, is Victoria was hit with some very serious kind of bushfires. In fact, we probably experienced some of the hottest days over last weekend, where Wednesday and Friday, we hit over 42 degrees, and the consequences, especially combined with wind were quite devastating for regional Victoria. So we might draw a bit from an article that was published in the pages of Green Left commenting on these bushfires. Then the other kind of major event that happened has been the whole debacle with the Adelaide Writers Festival. Now, this is quite a big story in a lot of ways, because what had essentially happened is that the Adelaide Writers Festival, due to pressure from the Labor Premier. Now, I need to correct myself. Yeah, it's a Labor Premier. Put in South Australia, because for a while I actually thought it was a Liberal Premier, but it's actually been a Labor Premier. So the Labor Premier had actually put...
How could you mix up Labor and Liberal?
Yeah, well, it's not hard to mix them up. Yeah. Anyway, what had happened is that the Labor Premier had essentially put a lot of pressure on the board of the Adelaide Festival Corporation, who had essentially interfered in the programming of the festival to essentially remove the Palestinian author Randa Abdel Fattah. And she was essentially removed from the program, and the reasons that were cited was on the basis of cultural safety, following the events at Bondi. And in fact, we'll be having another discussion about one of the other kind of aftermaths of that. And essentially what happened in response is a large number of writers in solidarity with Randa Abdel Fattah had essentially withdrawn from the festival in a very similar situation to what had happened to the Bendigo Writers Festival. Then the resignations kept coming in, and what had later happened is some of the more prominent people had withdrawn from the festival, including Jacinta Ardern, who's the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, and also Bob Carr, who actually at the start had defended removing her from the program, despite the fact that he claims to support Palestine. So, and then of course the other thing as well is, the board of who organised the festival resigned, including the person who had organised the programming, which was Louise Adler, and she was essentially the director of Adelaide Writers Week. So she's the one who made all the decisions to invite all the writers. She specifically invited Randa Abdel Fattah, along with a number of other kind of Palestinian writers. She is part of the Jewish Council of Australia, and has been, quite a consistent voice that is critical of Zionism as a Jewish woman. So yeah, she wrote a very good op-ed piece in The Guardian. And I think, she very much, I think, made a very kind of good point about, why we should not give into this sort of era of censorship. Why this kind of deliberate attempt to kind of silence writers, etc., is something that we absolutely should not stand for. Now, getting into the current, and I definitely recommend people who are listening to actually read Louise Adler's opinion piece that was published in The Guardian. I think it is very powerful, and the title of the article is "I Cannot Be Party to Silencing Writers, Which Is Why I Am Resigning as Director of Adelaide Writers Week," and now, what has kind of happened next now? Because I guess one thing that was sort of happening in terms of discussions on the left, it was obviously a bit of a damper that the writers' festival in Adelaide was cancelled in its entirety following these series of resignations. Because one thing, it is, at the end of the day, it is similar to the Bendigo Writers Festival. It is a cultural event where the majority of the events are free. And at the end of the day, working class people and people in Adelaide in South Australia do actually have a right to have access to the arts, etc. So I think that was a bit unfortunate. But I think a few things that have to be said about it. I mean, the fact that the Adelaide Festival Corporation has essentially been forced to apologise to Randa Abdel-Fattah, I think should be taken as a victory. In fact, they gave a bit of a non-apology the first time around, and then next, following the increased pressure, they gave a serious apology. And of course, they've also committed to inviting her to speak at its next event in 2027. So I think this is, I think the fact that that had happened actually makes this a victory in a lot of ways. And I think it's a victory against the Zionist lobby in a lot of ways, because I think the Zionist lobby was very much played a big role in putting a lot of the pressure on the Adelaide Writers Board. But I think it's also a victory for the Palestine movement, because even then, because really at the end of the day, a lot of the writers, they're not necessarily working class activists. They're generally, you know, quite well off kind of writers. The fact that they feel very confident to stand in solidarity with Randa Abdel-Fattah, I think is reflective of the what we have actually achieved as a movement. Palestine is part of the everyday kind of consciousness, and people are willing to take a firm stand when the moment calls for it. And I think, you know, I think all the credit to Louise Adler for taking the position that she has had, because, you know, to essentially resign, you know, it essentially is almost like resigning from a job.
It's a lot of work to pull all those writers together for a big festival like that.
I think this is definitely, you know, quite a positive news story. And in light of all the horrible kind of things that is happening, I mean, Israel is still bombing Gaza. I mean, the genocide is continuing, although at a much slower kind of rate than it was compared to the mass bombings that was experienced in 2023 and 2024 and most of 2025. I think, you know, this speaks to the strength that the Palestine movement, and because I could never imagine this would have happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, or even 2 years ago. Yeah, what a big act of solidarity shown from those 180 authors and speakers withdrawing in protest against Dr. Randa Abdel-Fattah's very unjust cancellation from the Writers' Week. And also, like you said, Jacob, Louise Adler resigning as the director of Adelaide Writers' Week, saying that she cannot be party to silencing writers. And as writers here at Green Left, we stand with them. And yeah, Adler was saying that, you know, she strongly opposes disinviting the Australian Palestinian writer, saying it weakens freedom of speech. And yeah, I obviously agree with that. But even though there has been this apology from the Adelaide Festival Corporation, the reputation of that entire festival as a platform of so-called free exchange, it's meant to be, you know, a free exchange of ideas and debate, I think that the platform has now sort of been weakened. It is actually just meant to be this, it's meant to be a celebrated annual cultural event that has lots of different people from around the world coming together and sharing their ideas. And obviously the Zionist lobby and the premier would rather see an event like that get cancelled rather than have a Palestinian speak. So we do want to point out the hypocrisy of silencing a pro-human rights Palestinian voice like Dr. Randa Abdel-Fattah, and it shows the amount of dehumanizing that's continuing and racism and Palestinian hatred, even at a cultural literary event like this. And I think there is still a rally that's going to go ahead in Adelaide outside the Premier's office at 12 p.m. protesting the Premier and the Israel lobby for wrecking Writers' Week. So if you are tuning in from Adelaide or you know anyone there, tell them to meet in front of the Premier's office today, 12 p.m. And that's being organised by Australian Friends of Palestine Association.
The state government has sold 578 hectares of public land to private developers. They're building private public partnership model housing over public housing land, and it's just not on.
Housing is just massively expensive. It's never been effective in this country to rely on the market to provide decent housing for people.
Rent has risen by 21%. That's median rent across the country as of January this year.
As the rents keep rising, so must we. And we must stand together as a collective, because this war cannot be won by the few. It will only be victorious by the many.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical. You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So I want to kind of start a bit of a kind of discussion on what has kind of, you know, coming out of, you know, the horrible Bondi massacre. The Albanese Labor government is attempting to kind of push, you know, new dangerous new laws against dissent. Now, just to give you a bit of insight into these kind of laws, there is a proposed bill by the Albanese government, and in fact, I'm pretty sure that they've recalled Parliament. They've pushed Parliament back a week, in fact, and it's going to be meeting, I think, for 2 days to essentially pass this new sort of legislation. Now, just to give a bit of an insight into these new laws, now it would seem pretty reasonable. Okay, so the Albanese government is proposing a bill to combat anti-Semitism, hate and extremism. Now, that sounds on the face of it, if you're looking at it from in a real abstract sense, it could be construed as a good thing. And in fact, I guess that's what the Albanese government is relying on. But really, there is the main purpose of these new laws that are being proposed is really to attack the Palestine Solidarity Movement. Mm. And What the law is doing is there is essentially creating a new changes to criminal law where there's essentially going to be a new offence for inciting racial and including ethnic and national hatred, and essentially they also want to implement a scheme for outlawing hate groups and provide the Australian state with more means to police and imprison those who are denied power, starting with those who face racism. And I think it is very much, this is very much an assault on democratic rights, and it very much provides the Australian state with more means to police and imprison oppressed groups, starting with those who face racism. Essentially, what these laws give the power to do is, if the government could, because essentially they've been trying to paint the Palestine movement as a hate movement, specifically the slogans "globalize the intifada." They've essentially tried to make the argument that the slogan "globalize the intifada" makes Jewish people unsafe. Therefore this is inciting racial hatred against a particular group. And I think the law would essentially, if it was passed, give the government the ability to criminalise people who might adhere to particular politics, etc. And of course, you know, on the face of it, it does seem like a positive thing that the National Socialist Network, in response to these new laws, has made the decision to disband. Now, the National Socialist Group or Socialist Network is a neo-Nazi organization. It's absolutely promoting it's promoting fascism and racism and all sorts of horrible things. But at the end of the day, okay, while they've essentially disbanded and they will be banned under these new laws, we can't forget that National Socialist Network adherents will still find the way to propagate their racist ideology, because at the end of the day, racism has essentially been normalized by the same politicians and the mainstream media that has been coming out in support of these laws to tackle hate speech, which I think in a lot of ways reflects the kind of issues and the real limitations of leaving it to capitalist states to actually address these issues. And in the article published by Pip Hinman on New South Wales Labor Inquiry Pushes Dangerous New Laws Against Dissent, there is kind of like a good kind of quote from Michelle Birkin, and basically says on this whole issue of anti-Semitism, you know, said that no group should be allowed to monopolize the discourse on trauma and use it to curtail the legitimate rights of others. No objectively Jewish trauma-triggering events can be linked to the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Australia. And at the end of the day, she said, basically argued there's no grounds to call for a ban on the use of slogans that neither vilify nor call for violence against individual group. The slogans "Globalize the Intifada" and "From the River to the Sea, Palestine Will Be Free" express solidarity with people living under apartheid, occupation, genocide, and of course they are thus legitimate policy positions. So really, yeah, this whole attempt to kind of criminalize the chant "Globalize the Intifada," I think is a lot outrageous. But of course, I mean, one of the bizarre things about the singling out of this slogan is it's not even really a key chant at Palestine rallies. In fact, it's probably one that's not heard as often. Although that said, I think there is now a case that at Palestine rallies we should be shouting it more. And I also think, you know, it's actually rooted in a lot of Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism to claim that "Globalize the Intifada" is racist or inherently inciting hateful speech, because really, the word Intifada literally means to shake off, and essentially it's essentially like saying, you know, like almost like a direct translation, although I'm probably wrong here, I'm not an Arabic speaker, but you know, my interpretation is a direct translation of "Globalize the Intifada" would almost be like "Globalize the resistance." Mm. So I think, you know, I think it's pretty outrageous that the government is deliberately targeting a Tigrayanist slogan that essentially does not, that they're being completely disingenuous. But yeah, I think it's going to be very important to oppose these laws that are being proposed. We need to make the arguments that these laws actually have nothing to do with addressing hate speech. And in fact, most state governments actually have quite strong laws to persecute those who are deliberately promoting racism, etc., especially in the workforce and so on. Like, you know, the laws are almost sufficient that, you know, they are, you know, people can be persecuted for racial discrimination in the workforce and so. Obviously, they aren't perfect, but really, these new laws don't really have anything about ensuring safety for all marginalized groups. They're really, it's all very much about, you know, targeting the government, actually targeting the pro-Palestine movement, which premiers like Chris Minns have a strong track record of opposing.
Yeah, it is. It's actually pretty scary just how bad these laws are. And they're dangerous, and they give police more powers to repress the Palestine protest movement or anyone wanting to speak out against the genocide. And the New South Wales Labor's attack on the right to protest, like you were saying, Jacob, and it's got the support of the Liberals, it is designed to exploit a lot of fear amongst many communities and try to divide us, particularly following the Bondi Beach terror attack, and trying to weaponize that atrocity against the Palestine movement, blaming people who are against the genocide in Palestine as anti-Semitic, which is wrong. It's horrific. Labour Premier Chris Minns implying this link between the actions of the terrorists, Sajid Akram and Navid Akram, and creating a link between them and pro-Palestine protests is completely wrong, and we need to be able to highlight that. And the special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, Gillian Seagull, went even further, linking the peaceful 300,000-strong anti-genocide march over the Sydney Harbour Bridge to the Bondi killings. That's an example of one march that the Minns government tried to cancel. That protest really did push things forward, I feel. These new laws really do aim to repress the Palestine solidarity movement, and the reach will be a lot broader, and it will affect, if it goes through, it will affect vulnerable communities, particularly people who are more likely to face racism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think just one thing to note as well is there's a few different things that are kind of happening at the same time. So this law to combat hate speech is pretty separate from the anti-protest laws, although connected. Laws push that is coming from the New South Wales government, which the New South Wales government has essentially implemented. Now, the whole thing about these anti-protest laws is the government can say, oh, well, we're not actually restricting the right of protest. There's nothing stopping you from protesting, but essentially the police will essentially have the discretion to stop any protests from happening, or essentially stop any protests from being able to march across the streets, and they can justify all sorts of reasons. And of course they're trying to discuss similar laws in Victoria as well, although they're kind of starting off with the banning of face masks, etc. through things like designated zones, etc. So yeah, I think this is definitely a big concern, and I think, you know, we definitely have to remain opposed to this anti-democratic push by the Albanese government and state Labor governments. But yeah,
this deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the white Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together. And the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
is haunted like a beast that doesn't know its face, is frightening to behold. All the painted little gnomes smiling in a line, trying to get your votes. There's an architect setting fire to a house. All the plans were there, but they built it inside out. No one will endure what the sign told them they would. Beware of the dogs, beware of the dogs.
You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and you were just listening to a track by Stella Donnelly, Beware of the Dogs. That was a live version.
All right. So I wanted to kind of talk about one of the kind of major news stories that has happened in the past week, and I alluded to it at the start of the program, but this is the whole issue of the Victoria bushfires. Now, we had published an article 2 days ago that was by Alex Bainbridge commenting on the Victoria bushfires. And now, a few things to kind of note, you know, Alex kind of notes here that bushfires have kind of raged across Victoria, and Albanese said on January 11th that he had our backs, but this is in a way, this is simply not true, because the Labor government is continuing to approve new coal and gas, which is ultimately fueling the climate emergency. Now, these fires coincide with one of the worst heat waves in years. More than 500 structures, including 180 homes, have been destroyed, and at least one person has died. Multiple bushfires are still burning, although none remain at emergency level. Labor's assistance package provides a one-off immediate payment of $1,000 per eligible adult and $400 per child, which includes people who have been seriously injured or lost their homes. Now, course, it's good that the government is giving emergency assistance, but Alex points out that we need more than that. We need a government that will actually stand up to the big fossil fuel corporations, which are responsible for the climate change that is turbocharging extreme weather events. And I think, you know, the Labor government has been claiming that, you know, they're at the forefront of, you know, supporting people who have been impacted by this climate crisis, but Labor is very much doing the opposite. It has approved Woodside's major gas expansion in Western Australia, enacted business-friendly nature laws that ignore the climate impacts of new developments, and also an announced inadequate 2035 climate targets. It has also continued to subsidise the fossil fuel industry. Labor's bushfire package is $19.5 million. By comparison, subsidies to the fossil fuel industry totaled $14.9 million over 2024 to 2025, according to the Australian Institute. And of course, the Australian Institute said a record $67 billion is projected for fossil fuel subsidies. In budget forward estimates, this is more than 14 times greater than the total $4.75 billion disaster response fund. And really, I mean, the last year was the second hottest year on record, surpassed only by 2024. And really, these next several years have continued a recent trend of exceptional unexplained warming. The last 3 years, by a wide margin, have been the hottest ever recorded. That means that the three-year average for 2023 to 2025 is on track to exceed 1.5 for the first time. And of course, really, the climate changes, this is, if these past 3 years prove anything, it's that climate change is absolutely real and is caused by capitalist-driven human activity. And I think this evidence is incontestable. And I think really, this is where the fact is, we're also living in a time where where the United States President Donald Trump announced on January 7th that the US would withdraw from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And essentially, this is just an act of climate vandalism. Not that the framework is necessarily strong enough either. But the fact that the Trump administration has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement for the second time, ramped up oil and gas production, massively cut funding to climate science, scrapped major offshore wind projects, and rolled back more than 140 environmental rules and regulation, it's really all part of this kind of mantra to kind of just keep drilling. And really, the Trump regime has successfully pressured other global countries to backtrack on existing climate targets and implement very weak climate plans. So really, yeah, when the Albanese government says that he has our backs in the face of this climate disaster, I think it is a bit of a total joke in a lot of ways.
Yeah, this is truly a climate-fueled crisis that's caused by capitalism, and there is no planning amongst the rich nations to actually phase out fossil fuels. We all know that, even though it's affecting rich nations like Australia, although in Australia it's actually the poor and the working class communities that are the most impacted. For example, 66% of heat related deaths are occurring in socioeconomic disadvantaged areas. And yeah, like I was saying, the cooperation between capitalist nations, there's no planning amongst them to phase out fossil fuels and look for alternatives. Most of the cooperation between capitalist nations are for war against poor countries and people like Palestine. Which actually contribute to the ecological disaster. And yeah, it's just going to get worse. So we need to keep building the climate movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And just give all the solidarity with the climate activists who face court.
Yeah. Trying to stop the coal ships.
Trying to call through as part of their participation in the Rising Tide blockade that happened last year. Anyway, we'll possibly play another quick song, and then we'll go on to our first live interview for the program. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
We're not meant to have anything nuclear in our country.
It's really important and urgent that Australia gets serious about nuclear disarmament.
Well, nobody anywhere on the planet has figured out how to deal with highly radioactive waste.
Most of those who've managed nuclear weapons consider this to be the most dangerous time that we've ever lived in, with the danger of nuclear war at unprecedented levels.
You're listening to Radical Radio 3CR.
I heard a rumble in the night, like a big one-sided fight. It was the sound of shock and awe, like we heard in years before. When they started blasting boats, took a break from rigging boats to descend like birds of prey. No war, nowhere, no way. They always say they've got a plan. How'd that work for Vietnam? Then they send the poor to fight while they keep the office wide. But the criminals in charge want murderers at large. So there's one thing left to say. No war, nowhere, no way. All the talk up regime change, but deceptions become plain. When do you invading foreign soil for the cause of cheap or oil? When they roll the global dice, make the gentle pay the price. Don't let them blow it away. No war, nowhere, no way. When the fog of war is vague, it's time to put them in the hay. Keep on pushing till that day. No war,
Three CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and you just heard a song before by friend of the show, Les Thomas, who wrote a song in solidarity with Venezuela.
Okay, so we're very happy to be joined today for our first live interview of the program. We are joined by Federico Fuentes, who is a regular writer on Latin American politics. He is also the editor of Lynx, International Journal of Socialist Renewal, and also a member of Socialist Alliance. Fred has also had quite a lot of lived in Venezuela for several years, working as a researcher and correspondent for Green Left from Caracas during the Hugo Chavez presidency. And he is joining us today from Gadigal country and Sydney. So I guess I'll start off, maybe I'll ask the first question and then Chloe can follow up with the next question. So Fred, can you give us a bit of an update on the situation in Venezuela since the US military's invasion less than 2 weeks ago?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program. Yes, so as your listeners obviously are quite well aware, on January 3 we had a very, very serious attack on not just really Venezuelan sovereignty, but really an attack on human rights, peace, and the future for the peoples of Latin America, when the U.S. military assaulted Venezuela, in particular the capital, Caracas, kidnapping President Nicolas Maduro, and Celia Flores, who often the media just referred to as his wife, but is in her own right a high-ranking politician, having been previously the head of the National Assembly. What we saw, of course, in the immediate aftermath, in the first day or so of that attack and kidnapping, was quite a lot of shock and sort of uncertainty in the streets of Caracas and across Venezuela of what would happen next. Would there be a follow-up attacks? Would the U.S. military be back to try and capture more people from the Venezuelan government? As of yet, nothing of that has happened, even though the Trump administration has certainly threatened that possibility. Instead, what we're seeing is sort of two parallel sort of actions that have been occurring. On the one hand, we've seen some important, although, must be said, far from tremendously huge demonstrations throughout Venezuela calling for the release of Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores. Probably talk about protests in the tens of thousands. They're demanding that. Now, of course, that's a really important demand. We can't allow such actions as what has occurred to just go without any protest and allowing to set such a dangerous precedent. At the same time, though, what we've seen is a quite remarkable shift in the relationship between the Venezuelan government. Now no longer, with Nicolas Maduro at the head, but now with Vice President Delcy Rodriguez as having been sworn in by the Supreme Court as the acting president. Now we've seen a rapid change in relationship between that government and the government in Washington and Donald Trump administration, where the two have started to work on establishment of diplomatic missions in both countries, right up to including re-establishment of the U.S. embassy in Caracas. We've seen the two governments talk positively about oil contracts that will be signed, including the two governments coordinating to bring back oil tankers that had left the Venezuelan ports with so-called sanctioned oil. Venezuela has been sanctioning Venezuelan oil for quite a number of years, and in the last few months have been essentially carrying out a naval blockade of the country. But this time around, the Venezuelan government was actually cooperating with that. And then we saw just in the last 24, 48 hours, the official phone call between between Delcy Rodriguez and Donald Trump, both of which expressed that they'd had a very cordial discussion based on mutual relationship talk about how they can move forward from here. So as I said, so we've seen those two seemingly parallel or opposing trends that have been occurring in the last few days of continuing protests raising the issue of the need to return Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores. At the same time, a rapid new reshaping or forging of new ties between the two countries.
Yep, Fred. Thanks for joining us this morning. We wanted to also ask about how these U.S. sanctions, the blockade, and then lately the bombing and the invasion of Venezuela by the U.S. has actually impacted ordinary working class people in Venezuela. And you did talk a little bit about how they're organizing against it through protests, but even just broader for listeners, how does imperialism actually kill people and perpetuate racist tropes that actually contribute to the repression of people, not just in Latin America, but in all global South countries?
Yeah, look, I think in terms of the sanctions, a really important question, and there's probably like two or maybe we could say three important ways in which they impact on Venezuela. On the Venezuelan people. The one is, and this is undeniable. I mean, there's been various reports, even including in journals such as Lancet, looking at the very serious impacts that economic sanctions have on ordinary people's health, ordinary people's ability to access food, and the dramatic impact that they have in terms of reducing levels of nutrition, reducing access to life-saving medication. This has caused, of course, in the case of Venezuela, where particularly since 2017, and with a real ramp where we have big financial sanctions that are imposed on the government, making it essentially impossible for it to be able to access bank loans, to try to be able to get the extremely necessary funds it needed at that time to deal with the very huge economic crisis that the country was in, and then followed up even more steeply with the oil sanctions again imposed in 2019 by the United States. We see really over that period of time a dramatic drop in people's living standards, and poverty skyrockets, and literally, you know, people have tried to tally the numbers of deaths as a result of those sanctions, and we're talking about at least in the tens of thousands of Venezuelans who, it could, you know, normal circumstances should not have died because they should have had access to the medication they needed or better nutrition. So that's on the first level. On the second level is of course that when a country is under such a intense sanctions regime, which is, of course, you know, the U.S. government has been quite open about it. The whole purpose of having the sanctions regime was the idea that they would be able to strangle the economy and kind of force people out on the streets to oppose the government and bring them out to protest. So, the, you know, the real aim here of these sanctions has been a political one, that is to overthrow the government. When you create such a scenario, of course, the government itself then tends to become quite more repressive, and we've certainly seen that in Venezuela in the last few years with the increasing crackdown, not just on the traditional right-wing opposition, an opposition that, you know, must be said has been involved in the last 20 years or involved in subversive actions that have sought to undemocratically overthrow elected governments through various means and coups, hiring of mercenaries to try to overthrow the government, shutting down the economy, in particular the oil industry, and the management going on strike there to try to bring down the government. So the right-wing opposition have been involved in all these sorts of activities for a long time. But whilst they've, of course, been part of the target of this repression, also just ordinary people have increasingly bore the brunt of this repression, be that the trade unionists who basically unable to organise in the Venezuelan situation, or left-wing progressive parties, the vast majority of whom have been electorally intervened and had their electoral registration stripped of them, so unable to run in elections. I'd say the third way that it's also had an impact on the people of Venezuela is that this sanctions regime has ultimately had also the impact of changing the, whilst it wasn't able to carry out regime change, as is the term very much often talked of and used in the context of Venezuela, in the form of removing one government and replacing it with another one, it has been able to carry out a certain regime change, and that is that it's been able to drastically modify the policies of the Maduro government. So we see a real big shift in the policies of the Maduro government from when Maduro was first elected in 2013, where we have a lot of continuity with the economic and social policies of the Chavez government, very big shift in those policies and the orientation of the government away from that sort of progressive pro-poor agenda towards one by the end of Maduro's time in government, which is one that is quite anti-worker, much more pro the rich, and a policy actually that perhaps starts to help us explain how it is that Delcy Rodriguez government can so rapidly, less than 2 months after Maduro has been kidnapped, be establishing the kind of relationships we're seeing with Washington.
Yeah, so thanks for that, Fred. I guess I want to go into the kind of next question, which is really about what the United States has kind of been kind of doing. And I guess you've talked a bit about the impact that this has had on ordinary working class people, but obviously there's kind of a broader political context, the United States actions. So the United States has seized another Venezuelan-linked tanker, and which is ahead of a meeting that US President Donald Trump and Venezuelan opposition leader Marian Corano Machado are supposed to be having. Is the US evasion just about seizing oil? What do you think are the kind of deeper reasons for what the United States is doing?
I think when we talk about Venezuela, it's of course impossible to avoid the question of oil. given that Venezuela sits on the largest proven reserves of oil in the world. But I think to understand really what's happening in Venezuela today, can't really just limit it to the question of oil. I think there's two other really, and perhaps arguably even more important factors that need to be taken into consideration. I think one of them is not just who has controlled that oil, but also who's denied access to that oil. And that's a very clear message that the U.S. administration is sending, not just obviously to those who are governing in Caracas, but to the world and most specifically to Russia and China as the two sort of, let's say, large powers that are competing with the United States on the global stage. And what the U.S. has said with this action is that Venezuela's oil, and we should add to that its natural resources, because Venezuela is quite rich in other minerals, particularly some important rare earth minerals. But it's saying to the rest of the world that the U.S. believes that Venezuela's resources and more broadly the resources of the Americas belongs to the U.S. So I think that's a really important aspect to it. And then related to that is really that this is, let's say, the first open act, the real launch, not the media launch, but the real launch of Trump's new national security strategy. One that in paper form came out in December, but in real life form began on January 3. And this strategy makes it very explicit. It says, look, in the world that we're moving into, the U.S. realizes that it can't really continue to try to be the world cop, as it used to be, the world police officer, looking after the whole world. Instead, it has to focus on its interests, and most immediately that means really asserting full spectrum dominance in the Americas. And I say the Americas, not just talking about Latin America, but it's been very much in the news in the last few days, last few weeks. This extends all the way even to include places such as Greenland. But it's saying that the US must politically, economically, militarily control the region. I think that's really what we're seeing across the region in terms of the US actions, where it's been on the one hand, in terms of politics, very much brazenly, openly supporting pro-Trump politicians that have been, through that support, been helped in some cases to win elections across the region. Economically, we've seen how it's very much been using the tariffs to try to punish governments that step out of line. The most clearest example being Brazil, where tariffs were imposed, not for any sort of trade reasons, but specifically because Trump believed that the Brazilian government was persecuting his friend, former President Jair Bolsonaro, who attempted a coup against the democratically elected president of Brazil. And then, of course, militarily, as we've seen in Venezuela, where the kidnapping of Maduro and Flores very much is a message to the region to say, look, what we say goes, and anyone who tries to step out of line will be removed, as we saw on January 3.
And what is the Australian government's role in US imperialism? Does Labor back Trump's illegal assault on Venezuela?
Yeah, well, look, particularly since after World War II, we've seen how, Australia went from having been a very natural ally of the British government, of British imperialism, in a global sense. And, of course, there was a logic there through the whole issue of colonialization. But with the US's rise as the main world sort of superpower after the Second World War, since that time, Australian governments and Australian big business have decided that their political and economic interests aligned and were best suited by aligning themselves with the policies of US imperialism. And that's what we've seen, whether it's the joint operations in Vietnam, through to the war in Afghanistan. But as I said, actually, what we're seeing now is that the US government no longer believes that its role is as acting as that world cop. And he's starting to, is part of helping to further reshape a world that is in flux and that is in change. The Australian government, though, is refusing to accept that reality and continues to want to stick to its alliance with the US, including most obviously through military alliances such as AUKUS. So I think the actions in Venezuela on January 3, the military assault and kidnapping of the president, one more example of why it's so important for us here in Australia to continue to campaign to break that alliance with the US. It was wrong yesterday when the US sought to act as the World Cup and enforce really enforce the interests of the rich, enforce the rich of not just the rich in the US and in Australia, but of the rich countries against the poor. Today, now, the US doesn't see its role as that anymore, just sees itself simply defending its own interests, purely only the interests of the US rich, purely only the interests of the United States. And so what we need to be sort of advocating for here, I think, in Australia is to break with that alliance and to forge a different type of foreign policy, one that prioritises peace, human rights and sovereignty, starting from Australia and our near region. And, of course, the issue of sovereignty here in Australia is a very pertinent and important one because that applies even internally to our own politics here, but in the region and right throughout the world.
Yeah, so just want to go into the... Brett, I'm out of time a bit now, but we have room for one more kind of question. I guess in terms of a concluding response, Fred, can you tell us about how should solidarity activists respond and how, you know, why is it important to build a kind of mass movement opposing US imperialism, aggression and showing solidarity with Venezuela?
Yeah, so look, what I would say is, again, probably three very quick things, knowing that time is short. And the first is, as I've mentioned before, we absolutely have to be demanding the release of Maduro and Flores. We can't allow such illegal and dangerous action to go ahead without any response. So that is really an important aspect of what we need to be campaigning for. We're calling on the Australian government to, alongside breaking its alliance with the United States, to also be pressuring the United States to do that. That's the first thing that I would say. The second thing, though, is that I don't think our response can solely be limited to that. I mean, what we are seeing really today in Venezuela is one of the most starkest examples of a return to the kind of colonialism that the world hasn't really seen for about 100 years. And that is where colonial power, in this case the United States, essentially just simply absorbed for itself the right to make the main decisions in another country. And we're seeing that play out right now as the US is the one that is seizing control of Venezuela's oil. The US is the one that's selling the available oil. The US is the one that's negotiating the new contracts for Venezuela, for oil companies to go into Venezuela. So this extreme loss of sovereignty that's occurring right now in Venezuela really needs to be discussed, needs to be talked about, needs to be raised. Again, this is something that cannot be allowed to go ahead without any kind of response. And then the third thing that I think is really important, I think it's related to those last two, is that we really need to seek out how we can get more voices from Venezuelan trade unionists, Venezuelan progressive activists, environmental activists, indigenous rights activists, people who for many years now have been campaigning for many different issues, opposing both US's attacks on its countries, and particularly the sanctions, and now, of course, the military assault on its sovereignty, but also, you know, raising questions about the policies of the Maduro government, and now certainly are raising a lot of questions about what is happening under the Rodriguez, under acting President Delcy Rodriguez and the new government, thinking of ways that we can help to join with their campaign, support their campaigns as well, because I think one important aspect that's been lost in all of these discussions, and is unsurprising because it's the one of least interest for the government of Donald Trump, is the question of Venezuelan democracy. We have no discussion that's been happening there about, well, what's going to happen there in terms of the expansion of democratic rights in Venezuela, ones that have been heavily curtailed over the last period, as I said, for a variety of reasons. From US actions in the country, through those of the right-wing opposition, and as well as those of the Maduro government. So hoping to see how we can support like-minded activists in Venezuela who are obviously today finding themselves in a very difficult situation to rebuild and turn that situation around is a really important aspect, I think, of what our solidarity should be about.
So for listeners just tuning in, we've been speaking with Federico Fuentes, who's a writer on Latin American politics and an editor of Links, International Journal of Socialist Renewal. Encourage everybody to read that. We've been talking about the political situation in Venezuela right now. We want to thank you very much for joining us this morning, Fred, and also to advertise the fact that you are coming to NAM Melbourne on January the 29th, is it, Jacob? The public forum that we're holding.
Yeah, so it's going to be on Thursday the 29th of January, and we're still working out a venue at the moment, so it's going to be, but it will be happening at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday the 29th of January.
So we'll see you then, Fred, at that public forum. Looking forward to hearing you as a speaker, and I think we've also got a couple other speakers lined up as well.
Oh, yeah, look, I'm greatly looking forward to that. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and please, you know, all of you keep up the great work there at the Green Left Radio program, and also at 3CR. Such a vital to get this kind of information out, which very, very rarely makes it into the corporate media.
Thanks, comrade.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I want to go straight into the Green Left activist calendar to highlight some of the important kind of events that are going to be happening this weekend. So there's going to be a LASNET open meeting at 11 AM at the Catalyst Social Centre at 144 Sydney Road in Coburg. Then on Saturday, January 17th, there's going to be a protest, Stand in Solidarity with Iran, which is going to be at 12 p.m. at the State Library in the city. Then there'll be the concert, A Gathering for Gaza, at 2 p.m. at the Port Melbourne Industrial Centre for the Arts, which I think will actually be a very good event. And then on Sunday, January the 18th, there's going to be a banner painting for the Invasion Day rally at 11 a.m. And then, I guess more importantly, on Sunday the 12th, January 18th, there'll be a hands-off Venezuela.
Yeah.
January 18th, there'll be a hands-off Venezuela protest at 12 p.m. at the State Library. And I also just want to highlight the Tunaminiwat and Maoboy Hina commemoration will be happening at 12 p.m. at the monument at the corner of Victoria Street and Franklin Street in the city, and that'll be happening at 12 p.m. So yeah, those are just some of the events, and just more importantly, get along to Invasion Day on January the 26th, on Monday, January the 26th at 10 a.m. outside the Parliament House.
Stay tuned for our final interview on the show.
بگو دوباره بمیرم، شاید دستم را بگیرم، پیدا کنی دشت دوباره، هی هی سیرا ماسترا، سیرا ماسترای تنها، زخمی پیدا کن مردی را که بخواند چه گوارا.
بگو دوباره بمیرم، شاید دستم را بگیرم.
یک مشت پر از گلوله گل چک 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 چکاچا می افتد سنگین روی پاک یک مشت پر از گلوله
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR. And we were just playing a song that was requested by the next guest on the show, Damoon Jehani. Welcome to Green Left Radio.
Thanks for having me. And yeah, that song was Hasis the Emperor, classic Che Guevara song in a Persian rendition. Would be a good thing to set the mood.
Yeah, thank you for suggesting it. Sorry we had to fade it out halfway through, but we'll try and play it another time on the show.
Yeah. So just jumping in, just introducing you, Damoon, to the rest of our listeners. So, yeah, we're happy to be joined today by Damoon, who is a Kurdish Iranian who is based in Nam, Melbourne. And he is also part of a group of Iranian leftists who are organising the upcoming protests that's going to be happening this Saturday at 12 p.m. at the State Library. So we have Damoon on the program to actually talk about... you know, about the protests in Iran. So, Damoon, can you tell us a bit about the roots of the protests and where have they kind of come from in the past 2 months?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the roots of the protests in Iran, it goes back to a long discontentment with authoritarianism. It is a mobilization that has rapidly expanded since 2009. So, in the last 16 years, we've had 6 major mobilizations in Iran, which for an authoritarian state like Iran, that has one of the highest execution rates per capita in the world, shows the thirst that people in Iran have for freedom, for liberation. And these are dynamics that we've seen play out for the last month in Iran. We have protests that initially emerged as an economic reaction by the merchant class, right? So it's interesting. It kind of takes us back to the 1979 revolution, the merchants coming out and going on strikes. And so this happens for a day or two. You have electronic shops in Tehran closing down their shops, and then other merchants across Iran see this and start following suit. But within a day or two, we start seeing a political message developing slowly from these strikes. And then, give it a few more days, we have university students in Tehran coming out to protest. Give it one more day, and you have much more larger, strictly political mobilizations taking place in Iran. And within a week, we're talking about around more than 20 provinces out of Iran's 31 being an open revolt. So in a backdrop, it's this long discontentment with authoritarianism that the Iranian people have not just faced since 1979, but during the monarchist dynasty we've had from 1925 to 1979. And in the recent mobilizations, it's the economic trigger that gets transformed into the classic political mobilization.
Yeah, and I want to kind of go into the next question, which is because you kind of highlight how a lot of these protests have kind of been driven by kind of economic concerns. And I want to kind of ask about, have the issues of women's liberation and rights for minorities and oppressed groups within Iran been taken up as part of these protests? Because they've very much been a key feature of a lot of the protest movements that have occurred in Iran in the past, and was very much the big part of the women life and freedom movement.
So here's where it gets a bit tricky. Women life freedom was probably the most intersectional event in terms of Iranian mobilization since 1979. I mean, a very slogan itself, right? It is putting as the fore and center of a struggle for women liberation. It was an event that took place in both Iranian Kurdistan and main urban centers like Tehran. This time around, if I have to be honest, we're not really seeing as many slogans about women-like freedom. Part of that, I think, comes that each mobilization in Iran does build from the previous, but also distinguish itself in one way. Another part is that I think in the protests that we've had in Iran, we have seen a larger presence of monarchist or more Pahlavi-friendly ambition. And in the Iranian monarchist camp, they kind of sit strictly opposed to the women-like freedom movement. They saw it as sort of opposed to their ideals. They thought that involved way too many political actors. And so, not that this is the entire reason, but this time around, for instance, whereas in women-like freedom, we had mobilizations in the more nationalist parts of Iranian Kurdistan, in the Sunni regions where Kurds have mobilized en masse for decades upon decades, this time around, we haven't even really seen those mobilizations take place in the Sunni parts of Iranian Kurdistan. We've seen it in other parts of Iranian Kurdistan, but in the past where we saw the largest mobilizations during women-like freedom, for instance, we haven't even seen that. And when I talk to people there, I talk to people from those regions, there is a slight even anxiety about the monarchist sort of presence. But again, as the sort of backdrop of all of this, it is still a quite intersectional event. It still involves a large segment of Iranian society. And even when you look at videos of protesters in Iran chanting certain things, like long live the king, it's not everyone. You're seeing maybe 40%, sometimes 20%, sometimes 5 people in the crowd. But then here comes the next big point. When you're in Iran, when you're facing a mobilization, when you're facing authoritarian violence, people don't have the capacity to distinguish themselves from one protester to another. Because at the end of the day, the boot of your authoritarian man is sitting on your neck.
We're speaking to Damoon Jahani, who's a Kurdish-Iranian PhD student based in Melbourne. I'm assuming you're still a student, Damoon. What are your thoughts on the opportunistic weaponization of the Iranian people's struggle by Israel and also the United States and their allies?
Yeah. So, I mean, in one sense, it gives me anxiety. You know, us as leftists, we have a very strong understanding of the history of imperialism, of how U.S. intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, so what we saw in Venezuela, you know, just recently, which is unparalleled, like something I couldn't even think about. So there is a sense of anxiety in terms of what Western interference looks like. And at the other end, there is a concentrated effort, at least to some degree, especially with Israel, to push the monarchist cause, to push the son of the last Shah, Reza Pahlavi. And Trump even mentioned his name a few days ago. Funnily enough, he called him a nice guy. But it was like, we have to see whatever opposition movements emerge in Iran as well, what other leaders come out of Iran as well. And so, you know, the Islamic regime has been one of the biggest geopolitical enemies of the United States, of the West in the region. But of course, you know, we're not campus. So we're not going to stand here and be like, well, Iranian people don't deserve freedom because the current regime is anti-imperialist. Solidarity extends to everywhere. But those anxieties exist. However, on the other end, the U.S. is also facing regional pressure. For instance, Turkey. Turkey is not the biggest fan of the regime in Iran. Sometimes they have their issues as well. But now from Turkey's perspective, well, look, if a mobilization happens in Iran, it's not just Israel they have to worry about. It's also the Kurdish movements in Iran, too. And so we've even been seeing Turkey and other regional states applying pressure on the U.S. And Israel to an extent as well, to not intervene as much. One point I do want to make, and this is intrinsic to my PhD in sort of understanding our oppositional dynamic. The protests in 2009 that we had, the protests in 2017 that we had, even to an extent the protests in 2022, Women Like Freedom, there wasn't this massive shift by the opposition to go towards American Israel. By here, I'm largely talking about the monarchists. This has something that has largely developed over four decades, and it comes out of desperation. So I'm not asking people to, you know, completely excuse some of the tendencies that some Iranians have, but the unfortunate reality of what authoritarian violence and decades of suppression does to a movement when it feels powerless. When, for instance, in Iran, we're having reports of 12,000 people killed in 2 days amidst an internet blackout that's been unparalleled, that people in times of desperation, unfortunately, seek the other geopolitical power to support them.
Yeah, and we encourage people to stand in solidarity with Iran tomorrow at the protest that you are part of organising, Damoun. It's tomorrow, Saturday, January 17th at 12 p.m. at the State Library. And just to highlight once again, Damoun, why it is important that we all show solidarity with the Iranian protesters.
You know, in one sense, decades of authoritarian repression. It's, you know, a place that I haven't even seen once in my life. A place where, you know, I have a friend who a week and a half ago said, I'm going to go join a protest, and I haven't even heard from him. And even being an Iranian leftist, it feels like we're in a tough spot now where there's, and very understandably, there's a part of the left that is anxious about both the monarchist movements, about both U.S. and Israel interference, about what the removal of the regime would do. But in these grander discourses of geopolitical battles, what's being lost is the very humanity of the people in Iran. And I deeply, deeply appreciate the articles and the support that groups like Socialist Alliance and other Trotskyist groups have been showing as well. But at the end of the day, you know, I have a father who fought against the Pahlavi dynasty and the Islamic regime. And man, we just want to go home.
Yeah, all the solidarity to you as well, Damoun, and your family. And we really hope that you can go back home and see probably family you've probably never met before and been separated from for so many years. And before we unfortunately run out of time, but are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with us and listeners before we wrap up?
Yeah, it's that, look, I'm a Marxist. I have my takes. I don't like the West. I don't like Israel. And I'm not necessarily for intervention. It's just that from a distance, we can look at a community, whether it's Cubans, Venezuelans, Iranians in the diaspora, and we can look at the flags they're waving, and we can use that to say they're a psyop. We can use that to say they're a coral of a revolution. And these are the sort of takes that even my own best friend who came to every single Women Like Freedom protest has told me this time around. But again, just the same message I said before, that if we're missing the sociological analysis of how people go and seek another geopolitical act of desperation, not that we should support it, but that is what the reality of, again, authoritarianism looks like. And that right now, the Iranian left is in a difficult spot. We're fighting against so many fronts, and it also feels like that we don't have as much support as we did during Women Like Freedom, and that's completely understandable as well.
Yeah. Well, all the solidarity, Damoun. And yeah, just a reminder to our listeners, there is going to be a protest tomorrow at 12 p.m. at the State Library in solidarity with Iran. And yeah, I think it will be a very kind of important kind of protest to kind of support and to show our solidarity.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Damoun, for joining us this morning and taking that time. And we'll see you tomorrow on the streets.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. See you soon.
Maybe we can play the rest of the song. It's only 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah? We'll go. Well, we can even play it from the beginning as well. How long is the song?
It's 4 minutes. I was thinking play the rest of it. Oh, yeah, we can play the whole thing.
Yeah, let's play the whole thing.
This is what Damoun requested.
Well, but just before we go, because this will probably take up the rest of the program, yes. Like to thank all our listeners for tuning in this week, which is our first live-to-air program of the year. And I think there's, well, I think if the start of 2026, we are going to be in for a big year, and there's going to be lots of news and stories of struggle that we're going to be covering in the coming weeks. So all solidarity. And yeah, and if you support the work we do, consider becoming a supporter by going on greenleft.org.au patreon.com/support.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks to our guests, Damun Jahani and also Fred Fuentes. Stay tuned for Left After Breakfast. We're going to go out on this song, Hasta Siempre, in Persian.
پیدا کنی دشت دوباره بگو دوباره بمیرم شاید دستم را بگیرم پیدا کنی دشت دوباره هی هی سیرا ماسرا سیرا ماسرای تنها زخمی پیدا کن مردی را که بخواند چه گوارا
Been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.